Thanks very much for that, Michael. Very flattering introduction. I'm a big fan of Bob Dylan. Blood on the Tracks is the best album that he did. In fact, it's one of the best albums of all time. But I couldn't think of a link with Bob Dylan and Dust, really, apart from the title. So there's nothing else about Bob Dylan from now on. Now, firstly, I guess one thing I have to say, of course, is a lot of what I'm going to present here and a lot of the work that I've done and a lot of the kind of inspiration that I've had is can be attributed to other people. And I wouldn't want to blow my own trumpet too much, because almost everything that we do as scientists usually is in collaboration with others. And there's a whole bunch of people, far too many to mention, really. I've picked up a few names, most of you probably won't mean much to you, that have been particularly important in the area of the work I've done on Dust, but there's a lot of other people, including Dominic, at the back there, who I've worked with for many, many years on other aspects of science, and all of whom have been influential and inspirational. So everything I show really is really the result of many people, many people's efforts. Now, but before we go too far, it's worth, I'd like just to put in a little note here. It's the sad death of Mr. Socrates Champao de Souza Vieira de Oliveira. Fantastic name, fantastic guy. So many people in the audience have got a PhD. He had a PhD. Some people in the audience, maybe doctors, of medical doctors, were in the medical school. He was a medical doctor. He was a social commentator, writer, philosopher. He had a PhD actually in philosophy, unlike some science. And he was a revolutionary, a socialist, anti-capitalist, and a very, very interesting character. Now, so lots of us, or some of us, have got PhDs and have. Some of us may even be anti-capitalist activists in the room, but very few of us can lay claim to having absolutely bossed the midfield at the highest level. The world stage, 1978 in particular, when I was a young, influenced young boy, and I used to watch the football, and this guy was an absolute genius. And just I'll take the opportunity just to demonstrate that genius. So there I was sitting in 1978 watching Scotland in the World Cup. This goal is not from this game against Scotland. They played Scotland. Scotland had a pretty good team at the time. And they took the lead. David Neri scored. Brazil then hit them with four absolute classic goals. But of course, the best of them all was against the Russians. So some of you may remember this. They don't make him like that anymore. If you compare him to David Beckham, wore some nice clothes, looked quite good. He didn't have a PhD, didn't transform a football club on socialist principles and common ownership and common democratic decision making like Socrates did. So a lesson to us all, just in case we think that we're a bit smart and a bit clever. This guy had all the brains and he had the guile and the skill on the football pitch where it really matters. Now, climate change. Socrates undoubtedly wrote something interesting about climate change, but I haven't read it. We're all concerned about climate change, and it's a big deal. And climate change is happening. The world's getting warmer. The climate's getting more extreme. And most of that in recent years has been down to anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a big issue, and that's what I've been concerned with for a number of years. But I came to Sussex actually to work with people who go beyond the science and go in and are really dealing with what we should really do about climate change. So scientists can tell us about why it's happening and what's going to happen potentially, but not what to do about it. So I'm really interested in working with people like David Ockwell here, who's interested really in developing energy policy. How do we make a transition to a low carbon economy? And also interested in working with people who deal with how we might respond to the impacts of climate change, the extremes that we might expect to see in the warmer planet in terms of, for example, how we're going to feed the world with 9 billion people in a radically different climate. So I came to Sussex really to work with those people and to develop a much more kind of interdisciplinary program on climate change, and I found that really to be a kind of fascinating and very fulfilling experience so far, and I hope that that continues. But what I do myself in most of the time is really to concern myself with the science of climate change and understanding planet Earth in all its glory and all its beauty. And of course, when we want to understand climate change, we have to understand the impacts of all the emissions of greenhouse gases from the modern world, but we also have to understand then what happens to the climate system in terms of the atmosphere, the effect on clouds, and how that influences the energy budget of the planet and therefore the climate, and also how it will influence the ice sheets on the northern and southern hemisphere. Anyone who's watching the frozen planet at the moment can get a really fantastic view of the beauty of that place, but also the radical changes that are taking place at the moment. The climate system also involves the terrestrial biosphere, all of life on Earth, and the carbon cycle, which determines how much of this stays in the atmosphere, and therefore how much will be there to warm the planet, depends critically upon what happens in the ocean and also in the major areas of rainforest. We need to understand that, and we need to understand other aspects of what we call biogeochemical cycles, the cycling of carbon and other elements around in the Earth system. And what I'm going to talk about today, dust, which you can see here from the Sahara Desert, plays quite an interesting role in that. But that's the big challenge for climate scientists, to understand and critically to model all those components. So what climate scientists do is that we divide the world into little boxes like this, and we have a number of equations which determine the wind speed, the temperature, the pressure, the carbon dioxide flux, the rainfall, etc., in every single box around the world. But doing that and understanding those equations and actually being able to code them up and making sure that they produce accurate simulations is absolutely the challenge that the scientists face, which feeds into policy on mitigation, on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and feeds into policy on what we might do to adapt to the changes that we expect to see. Because all of that policy is determined, is based upon the projections that climate scientists produce for the future, how much warming we expect to see, and the changes in rainfall, etc. So climate science plays a critical part in all that multidisciplinary effort into dealing with climate change. But I'm going to talk about one little bit of that, and I've already sort of had a little picture there of dust blowing from the Sahara Desert there. I'm going to talk about aerosols. Aerosols we know about in our own lives, from aerosol cans, which reminds me of a time I was recently in Sweden, and I was at a conference, and I noticed that I was a little bit smelly under the armpits. So I popped along to the chemist, and I said, have you got a deodorant? And the chemist said, certainly, sir. Would you like Bal or aerosol? And I looked at him and said, well, neither is for my armpits. But so I quickly left. But of course, we have lots of different types of aerosols, not only the domestic kind, but also here, as we can see, natural aerosols from volcanic eruptions. The Icelandic volcano, a very good example of that, causing very important aviation hazards, costing the airline industries many billions. And of course, the aerosol community in the UK has been, every time I say aerosol from now on, you're going to think of one thing. Good, so the aerosol community has been involved in understanding exactly where the plume goes, and weather forecasts of the aerosol plume are important in determining which airports to shut down on which particular days. And then, of course, there are aerosols from human activities. This is a picture of Cairo, and you can see the smog overlying that city, typical of many, many cities around the world, and typical of UK cities until we deindustrialized. This is the kind of thing that we're actually interested in. This here, this strange fruit, it's a very small fruit. It's about 30 microns in size, so there's about 300 of those in a millimeter. This is an aerosol which actually has come from the Sahara Desert and was measured over Spain and has been influenced and has been sort of chemically altered. But it is actually a dust aerosol. And that's the kind of thing that we're interested in understanding. And Michael talked about the scale that we do analysis on. We're actually interested in scales from this to the planetary scale. And that's one of the big challenges for climate, is understanding the processes which take place at this scale and scaling that up to the globe. So why are we interested in dust? Now, people often ask me that. My wife frequently asks me that because she can't quite understand why anyone would want to spend public money on studying Saharan dust. In times of cutbacks, it's a good question. So why should we be interested in dust? Why is it important at all? Lots of reasons, actually. One, dust aerosols are the dominant atmospheric aerosol. So we've looked at volcanic aerosols and anthropogenic aerosols, but there's a greater mass of dust than there is of any other aerosol, including sea salt, in fact. So there is more dust in the atmosphere than there is any of the other types of gunk that are up there. Secondly, and from a climate point of view, and I've already showed you the globe and the challenge that climate scientists face in understanding and making predictions of the future, aerosols influence the radiation budget. They influence the energy budget of the planet, how much energy comes in and how much energy goes out. Energy coming in is shortwave solar radiation, energy going out is infrared radiation. And aerosols reflect and scatter a lot of the shortwave radiation, and they also do trap a little bit of infrared radiation, but they don't really act much like greenhouse gases. They act more like a sort of a reflective shield across the Earth. And so they influence the radiation budget, and the evidence of that is here. This is a model estimate of the amount of radiation leaving the planet, amount of energy leaving the planet, and it's the error in the model. It's the Met Office, the UK Meteorological Office forecast model for the globe, and it's got a huge bias right over the Sahara. Too much energy leaving. And that's because there's no dust in this particular model. Dust is, at that particular time, is too complicated to model, and therefore it wasn't included. Big error in the model. Therefore, that means forecast errors. It means that our climate and weather forecasts are not very good. When we include aerosols, we get an improvement in those models. More importantly, they influence clouds. Aerosols exist in the cloud layer, and in particular, the Saharan dust which comes off the Sahara, gets transported right out across the Atlantic, which is exactly where we see these trade wind cumulus clouds, which are very typical of that region. And when we look at the aerosol effect on that, this is a slide from Joram Kauf, and what it shows basically is the amount of cloud and the droplet size as a function of how much dust there is in the atmosphere. When there's not much dust, there's less cloud, and the particles are actually bigger. In fact, the scale's inverted. When we have more dust here, the black line, it produces more cloud and smaller particles, brighter and clouds and more of them. And that has an even bigger effect on the radiation budget of the planet. This complicated slide here, don't bother reading it. All it's basically saying is what are the changes in the energy budget, and the energy budget drives climate change. That's what climate change is all about. It's changes to the energy budget of the planet. Whoops. These are the greenhouse gases. They have warmed the planet by this amount. And these are the aerosols. These are actually just the anthropogenic aerosols. But you can see the biggest uncertainty, these lines here, are associated with aerosol processes. And that's just the anthropogenic ones, let alone the natural aerosols like dust. The biggest uncertainty in climate change projections and understanding radiative forcing comes from aerosol effects on clouds. So it's one of the big challenges that climate scientists face. Dust also has much, much more direct and tangible influence on our lives. Now, most of us here don't live in New Orleans, but this is what New Orleans looked like after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, kind of water world scenario. Terrible, drastic impact of hurricanes. Now, this was the 2005 hurricane season. Each line is a track of a tropical cyclone, a hurricane in the Atlantic Basin. This was 2005, and this was 2006. Very, very quiet season, very, very busy and radically damaging season in 2005. What was the difference between those 2 years? There's quite a few differences, but one of the main differences was the amount of dust in 2006 from the Sahara. And that dust was a very active season over the Sahara Desert, produced a lot of dust, which cooled the Atlantic Ocean. This is the difference. This is the Atlantic Ocean sea surface temperatures. You can see that the cooler patch here was a result partly of the impact of increased levels of dust on the Atlantic. A cool ocean means fewer tropical cyclones, less intense, and we had this very relatively quiet season in terms of tropical cyclones in the Atlantic. So in that particular year, dust did a good job of dampening down the destructive hurricanes. So I think I hopefully demonstrated the importance of aerosols directly to the energy budget of the planet, and then indirectly to sort of clouds and other weather systems. Another aspect of why dust is important is because dust aerosols are deposited around the world, and they can fertilize marine and terrestrial ecosystems, plankton in the ocean and plants on land. How do we know about that? Therefore, it can potentially influence the global carbon cycle. Climate change is all about carbon in the atmosphere, how much gets pumped into the atmosphere, how much gets sucked up by natural processes. The rest stays in the atmosphere and warms the planet. So climate change is all about carbon, and dust can play a role in that. Here's dust influencing radiation in clouds, but it also falls out of the atmosphere onto the land and onto the ocean, and it contains nutrients like iron, potassium, and phosphorus. Here's an example of the effect of that. Off the coast of the Atlantic here, off the coast of Africa, the green and the blue, which we can't see very clearly, actually are sort of plankton blooms. I can see them on this screen. They look lovely. You can't see them, but there's one here. But right around this, the Cape Verde Islands here, you can see these blooms of plankton in the ocean that are feeding on the nutrients deposited from dust. So plankton likes dust, all the way, in fact, to Florida. It's a bit clearer here. Toxic plankton blooms off the coast of Florida, driven by large inputs of dust from the Sahara. So important is dust, in fact, in what we call ocean biogeochemical cycles, like the carbon cycle, is that if we look back to the last glacial maximum, so those paleoscientists in the room might recognize, this is an artist's impression of what the world looked like about 15,000 years ago, ice stretching right around the northern hemisphere down to just north of Sussex, in fact. We escaped the ice, but Scotland was covered in about a kilometre thickness of ice. Much of North America as well. That's the last glacial maximum. And the rest of the world was pretty dry, very, very dry climate in the last glacial maximum about 15,000 years ago. Very different climate, cold and dry, and very dusty as a result. This is a computer simulation of the amount of dust deposition, not just over the Sahara, but right over these mid-latitude regions, in particular over China. This is the landscape of much of central China, the Loess landscape, L-O-E-S, L-O-E-S-S, deposited dust from the last glacial maximum. Many tens of meters of very loose soil deposited from within the dusty regions of Central Asia during the last glacial maximum. Glacial interglacial cycles, luckily we're not living in a glacial period right now, but the shift from glacial periods to interglacials, from the cold periods to the warm periods, this is the last sort of million years. This is the warm period we're in now. It was about 8 degrees cooler 10,000 years ago. What drives that shift? We know it's to do with the orbit of the planet around the sun, the Milankovitch cycles, but that's not nearly enough to produce these kind of temperature changes. So one hypothesis is that it's to do with the carbon cycle. Carbon dioxide concentration was low when it was cold and is higher when it's warm. And of course it's much higher now because we're pumping large amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Why is the carbon dioxide low and therefore the greenhouse effect less in the last glacial maximum? Well, one hypothesis is because the planet was dry, dusty, and dust was fertilizing the ocean, and the ocean was sucking the carbon out of the atmosphere. And there is evidence of that from these time series here, which shows that dust deposition in the ocean was higher and the iron content into the ocean was high at that in the last glacial maximum. Iron fertilizes the ocean, the plankton bloom, particularly in the Southern Ocean, and they suck carbon out of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide concentration goes down, temperature, greenhouse effect is reduced, temperature drops, ice age incurs. So dust play, and there's an estimate that basically about 50% of the drop in carbon dioxide concentration could have been due to dust. The world is very different today. It's much, much less dust than there was, especially in mid-latitudes where there's very little nowadays. But there's a hypothesis that dust was about responsible for about 50% of the drop in CO2 in the last ice age. And of course, the final reason that dust is important is because it's a health hazard. Respiratory illnesses, meningitis in Africa is influenced by respiratory inflammations associated with dust in what we call the Harmattan season, the winter season in North Africa, and it's also an aviation hazard. There's been at least one aeroplane crash related to dust aerosols. We've made lots of progress in recent years, and hopefully I'm going to illuminate this progress to you. And we've made lots of progress in recent years for a number of reasons. One is the advent of new satellite sensors, which tell us much, much more detailed information about the dust sources over North Africa. This line here represents the passing of this satellite, which looks down vertically and gives you the vertical profiles. This is height, and you can see the dust plumes here and here in this region across North Africa there. We'll come on to show these images much more. We've also spent lots of taxpayers' money on field campaigns. And I'm going to mention, talking in detail about two of these, Bodex 05 and Fennec, which I've been personally closely involved in. The size of the letters here is actually the spatial scale of the project rather than the budget, although AMA did soak up about 20 million euros of European investment in the AMA project. However, in contrast, the one which I was sort of personally a kind of principal investigator on here was had a much smaller budget, and we'll come on to that. So the field campaigns make direct measurements at the surface, lots of meteorological measurements here on towers and lots of dust samples, etc. We have research aircraft, which are bristling with technology, lots of instrumentation on these aircraft flying around above and through and below the dust clouds. And that's an example of the sort of the system on board. Lots of high-tech equipment, a bit like Air Force One. Unfortunately, we haven't had the US president on board yet, but I don't suppose George Bush would have been keen to fly at low levels across North Africa at any stage in his presidency. But we have lots of aircraft to do make those measurements, and we also have lots of, on the basis of these observations, we can start to improve our models. And the next IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, not the Independent Police Complaints Committee, report will use much more complex models, which do include aerosols, do include lots of different types of aerosols, dust aerosols. They've long included other aerosols, but they're going to include dust next time. And there are also forecasts in real time like this of dust storms around various parts of the world. But the accuracy is quite limited for reasons that I'm going to come on and explain. So that's kind of one fairly long introduction to why it is, a long justification of my existence, I suppose, and of why it is that dust is important. I hope we have demonstrated its role in the climate system. So what have we learned in the kind of work that I've personally been involved in, focused on the Sahara Desert? So I'm not so much interested in what happened at the last glacial maximum over China or the Northern Hemisphere or the high latitudes. I'm interested in what's happened right now over the Sahara Desert. So why is the Sahara so important? This diagram here shows you the aerosol concentration globally on average. It's over about 10 years worth of data from satellite. The colors here are the high aerosol concentrations. So what does it tell us? It shows the Sahara's the most loaded place in the world in terms of aerosol. This is all aerosols. There are other locations like down here off the coast of Africa and Brazil where biomass burning, fires from agriculture and forests produce smoke. And that's a different kind of aerosol. There is the East Asian aerosol plume, if you like, which is from industry. And there is the plume over northern India, which is a combination of industry and farming, producing a lot of aerosols there. But you can see this plume across the West Africa, across the Atlantic, coming from the Sahara. And Sahara is the number one location for dust, and it produces about 50% of the world's dust. Not surprising, it is the biggest desert in the world. When we get rid of all the other aerosols and we only look at dust, we see this, that one spot comes up as being the place for dust. And it's a sort of hotspot, the dustiest place on the planet. And that's what we knew for a long time, was just derived from the satellite data. That's all we had, really, because we haven't had routine observations of dust, because it's not been really considered to be a key meteorological variable. So that's what we knew about dust, and now we were intrigued by this hotspot here, this little bullseye just to the northeast of Lake Chad, which is active in the winter season here. This is basically the winter season, and is also active even in summertime. But of course, in summertime, something different happens, and I'm going to come on to that in a minute. But this is the annual average, the bullseye here. We were intrigued by that, and with some colleagues at Oxford, we set out to find out why. And that's the job, is to try to understand the spatial pattern of dust in the Sahara. It's not everywhere, the dust is located in key locations. Why is that? That location, that bullseye, turned out to be a place, and we look in different kind of satellite data, you can see the dust coming from it there, and that was the dust from the day before. It turns out it's located in Chad. And before that, I hadn't really thought much about Chad. Before I was interested in dust. Not many people do think about Chad. And it's located in a location in the north of Chad where there's sort of bright surfaces. So what is that? Well, if you look at a topographic map, it's what we call the Bodeli Depression. It's the lowest place in Chad. It's a depression, large depression. And this is about 120 miles across along that area of bright stuff there. And that's located in this depression. And it's basically old sediment from an ancient lake, a paleo lake that dried up about 5,000 years ago. So we decided with some colleagues from Oxford and Birkbeck and Salford to go and have an experiment there and actually make some measurements to try and find out why this place here, this location here, produces all this dust. And that was what we call the BODEX 2005, the Bodeli Dust Experiment. Now, luckily for everyone here, it didn't use up much taxpayers' money, as I'm going to come on to see. It was aimed to find out why it is that the Bodelli Depression is the largest dust source, how much dust is produced and where does it go, and what is the climate impact of that dust. How do we find out? Make some measurements and compare the measurements with model simulations. So, we got £12,000. Might sound quite a lot to some people here. It's quite a lot if you're on pocket, if you're on £3 a week pocket money, which your dad doesn't even give you most weeks. quite a lot of money, but not very much. Medical researchers would consider this to be pennies, and it is pennies. This is a proper Scottish research grant. It was done on a shoestring. Six people, 3 weeks in charge. Unfortunately, most of it didn't go on a massive carryout. In fact, you can't get a drink for love nor money in Chad, which is a good thing. And so the first one, when we arrived in Chad, six of us, first thing to do was get some beds. So we phoned up Beds R Us, and we got the number wrong, so we didn't get six. I think we got about 26. So that was sorted out, the beds. And then we packed up our... in fact, we gave almost all that £12,000 to a guy who arranged these three vehicles we had. He didn't go, of course. He just paid some other guys to drive for a pennies. But he made a lot of money out of it. Then we packed up, and then we drove off across the Sahel for 3 days. Through day and through night. Some of us didn't make it on the way. Across the Sahel from the sort of semi-arid zone into deep into the Sahara, and eventually we reached our target, the Bodelli Depression, the legendary, which has been beguiling the dust community for years, only no one had been there to find out what it's actually like. They'd just looked at those images from satellite. But then we turned up in the Bodelli and said, right, where do we start? So we set up a little camp. There's a tree in the middle of the Sahara. That's odd. And the reason, of course, is that because it's an ancient lake, the water table is about a meter below the ground. So if you do run out of water there, it's okay. Just dig a hole and you drink the water. So actually, you feel quite safe in a way because water is solved. And if you want to eat, if you run out of tinned peas, which we did do, then you just drive your truck at a gazelle, knock it over, and then eat it. So we set up some instrumentation, relatively simple instrumentation to measure the winds at the surface and also above the surface with balloons, measuring dust, etc., etc., etc. And then we sat there and we waited for 2 weeks, and nothing happened. And then the wind blew, and we got our dust on that we were waiting, that we'd been looking forward to so much. But it wasn't very pleasant. It was not very easy to do the work when it's blowing a gale and you've got dust piling, blasting your face. But we carried on regardless. And then we managed even to settle down for a team photo. So it was quite fun when the dust blew for about 20 minutes. And then the fun wore off. And then we had 3 days to sit out the dust storm. But eventually it stopped and our camp looked like this. And I'll explain why it looked like that in a minute, because it shifted an awful lot of material across our campsite. And you can read up on Nature, in an article about the project in Nature. We took a journalist along with us, but we got rid of him pretty quickly. We sent him home before the dust storm started. Journalists, they're not cut out for it. They've got, he had some parties to go to, I think. So, anyway, it was reported in Nature, and we're very pleased that it was. So the question was, why is it dustiest place on Earth? Well, we know it's because it's in this depression, and that depression consists, when you get there, of this very, very fine sediment, fine paleo lakes, basically old diatoms, old plankton that existed in that lake when it was filled with water. And they blow around. They're very erodible. It's not rocket science. The surface is erodible. Easy. So what erodes the surface? Well, it's the winds, as Michael already knows. And these are the winds across the Bodelli Depression. Why is it so strong? Because they're funneled. This is the Libyan high pressure system, takes the northeasterly winds across the region between two mountains, the Tibesti and the Nedi Mountains, the Nedi Mountains of Darfur, and it funnels. This is a sort of topographic. This is the Tibesti Mountains, the Nedi, Bodelli Depression. The low level, there's a wind called the low level jet, and we named it the Bodelli low level jet. We measured it first, that gives us the right to name it, and we called it the Bodelli low level jet. And it blows across those sediments and produces the dust storms that we see on average every 2 days in winter and on average every 3 days through the year. So those dust storms exist on average once every 3 days. And so we have this very, very marked diurnal cycle. The red line is the observed winds at the surface, and you go over about 10, 15 days, and you can see the diurnal cycle, and this is the dust storm here. diurnal pulsing. So it's a strong low-level jet, topographically constrained, that means funneled between the two mountain ranges, with this diurnal pulsing. And the diurnal pulsing is a really interesting feature because it produces these packets of dust. There's dust blowing during the day on one of them, one day, and there's the dust from the previous day. And you can see how quickly it moves around. It gets exported right across West Africa within a couple of days. So we found out the reasons why the Bedelia Depression produces this hot spot in the satellite picture. We found out why it was, because it's an ancient paleo lake with this very, very light diatomite sediment, ancient plankton that have died and sunk to the bottom. And because the winds are very strong, they get funneled between the mountains and they have this very, very marked diurnal cycle called an inertial oscillation, which produces these packets of dust which get pumped out across the region. We then set to work to answer how much comes out. Well, we worked out from our observations from the depression and sort of scaling up, we got 1.2 teragrams a day. What's a teragram? 1 million tons of dust. 1 million tons of dust a day when it's blowing. Every third day it produces, on average, that amount. Previous workers, Joram Kaufmann, had already worked out how much comes across the Atlantic from satellite data. And then with our colleague Ilan Koren and Joram Kaufmann, we worked out that basically about 50% of the dust which gets pumped out across the Atlantic and reaches South America, about 50% of that comes from the Bedelia Depression. And we tested that with a model. This is a model simulation of dust coming across the Atlantic. And this, the red number, is the proportion that comes from the Bedelia. And we do that by running the model with the Bedelia region active, switch it off, and run it again. And the difference is this. So it shows that this one location produces 50% of the dust based on our satellite observations and our observations from the ground, and also based on our model simulations. So the contribution for the total sort of aerosol loading is about 50% from the Bedelia. So what? So lots of dust gets pumped from across West Africa and across into the Atlantic and then across to the Amazon. Does that matter? That's not going to pay the bills. So why might it matter? Well, if we look in carefully in a scanning electron microscope at the dust itself, this is what you see typically. You get fragments of these diatoms, very strange creatures that have funny kind of angular and cylindrical shapes. And that's what the dust is made of. And Charlie Bristow from UCL worked out how much fertilizer there is in that material, in parts per million. Those numbers don't mean much to me. But it's got iron and phosphorus in it. And phosphorus and iron is what plants like. And then another colleague, Ben Amin, worked out by tracking individual events across the Atlantic using this satellite data here, this Calypso satellite data. Rather than using these sort of the sort of top-down instrumentation, he's able to use these vertical profiles which show you exactly where the dust is. It allows you to track individual plumes across the Atlantic. We put it all together. He did something equally important, in fact. He took observations of dust deposition in the Amazon, so rainfall measurements in the Amazon. You dry them out and you find out how much of this chemical signature is in there, and you combine it with the estimates of how much is in the dust itself, and you can work out how much gets, and we can track exactly when this rain fell, and we know that it comes that it was coincident with dust from the Bedelia Depression, and we can work out that we get a pretty substantial contribution of fertilizer into the Amazon from this one location, about 100 miles by about 50 miles across. That blob of bright surface area dumps many teragrams of iron and phosphorus onto the Amazon as a kind of fertilizer. We don't know what role that plays in the Amazon because we don't know to what extent the Amazon is nutrient limited, and we don't know the time scales on which the Amazon requires Amazon. I say Amazon, I mean Amazon rainforest, not the river. We don't know the times of which it requires that fertilizer, but there is the potential for it to be an important part of the ecology of that region, very remote from West Africa. But that's the contemporary process which we contribute to understanding. But actually, Charlie Bristow in particular in our team was interested in stuff from much further back. And he's interested in the last 5,000 years. I've got this slide here. This is a house which we discovered in the middle of the Bedelia Depression. And we're thinking, why would someone live in a place where you have dust storms every 3 days? And it's really profoundly unpleasant when there's a dust storm on. You can't really do anything. People live there because the water table is quite close to the surface and because of a little bit of vegetation, which they graze their camels on. And why is the water table so close to the surface? Because the whole area used to be a massive lake, and these are the shorelines of that ancient lake. And they did some dating on that, some thermoluminescence dating of those shorelines, and they've worked out that basically, this is current Lake Chad, which is a pretty big lake by anyone's standards. By England's standard, it's a vast, uninterrupted ocean, although it's getting smaller pretty rapidly, Lake Chad. But it used to be like this. It used to be the biggest lake in the world. It used to be bigger than Lake Superior, Lake Erie, in terms of area, bigger than Lake Victoria. It used to be 5,000 years ago, it was the biggest lake in the world. And it would have supported, of course, great wildlife and human populations. And of course, that is absolutely evident from rock paintings, etc., etc. This isn't in Bodeli, this is actually in Niger. This is a picture of a giraffe. And so it supported large human and animal populations about 5,000 years ago when the Sahara was a very, very different place, very green. This is another team of researchers who actually beat us to the Bodeli, but they weren't interested in dust or climate, and they didn't bother to make any measurements of wind or dust. They were only interested in, what do you call it, in paleontology. And it's a French researcher and his Chadian colleagues discovered a new hominid species called Tume, 7 million year old. So they found some remains, cranial remains in this location from 7 million years ago when the climate was even more different, of course, from what it is today. And it has its own name, Sahelanthropus chadensis, after Chad and the Sahel. And so it's a very fascinating place, the Bodeli Depression. Didn't expect to see. We found some crocodile skeletons in the sediment, in fact. But has its own remarkable history, the Bodeli Depression. But a more recent and equally remarkable history was in the 1980s. The first thing we noticed when we got to the Bodeli Depression was that it was actually covered in relics of munitions, rocket launchers, armored, sort of machine vehicles, machine guns and shells, lots of kind of Russian military hardware from the 1980s. And it turns out that, of course, in the Bodeli Depression, there was a great battle in 1986 when the Libyans were lined up at that time with the Soviets on the one side and the Chadians, the French, and the Americans on the other side. And Libyans came down from the north in a little bit like this. And they filled with all the Russian hardware, big, expensive hardware, and the Chadians came up from the south, a little bit like this. Sort of, who do you think you are kidding? Mr. Gaddafi. Of course, one dictator is much the same as the next. The Chadian leader was now being arrested for war crimes himself. He's arrested in Senegal for war crimes when he was backed by the CIA in a kind of very vicious regime. But anyway, they had a battle in the Battle of the Bodeli. And it was won by the Chadians and the French, the American-backed Chadians, who only had sort of Toyotas with machine guns in the back. And the reason they won it against all the firepower of the Russians was because the Russians had an airport here at Faye-Largeau, and they would have wiped the Chadians out had it not been for a dust storm on that day in March 86, when the Chadians made an advance, and the Libyans with the Russian aircraft couldn't fly because there's a big, horrible dust storm, just like we experienced. And the undercover of that dust storm, the Chadians with their very limited arms took out all these Libyan installations, and the remains of them are still there today. So fascinating history, in fact, the Bodeli Depression has, and I became quite obsessed with it at that time. But I kind of got over that obsession now and moved on to another part of the Sahara, the Western Sahara here. So if we look at the average picture of aerosols again, I'll try and cut to the chase quite quickly on this, I think I'm running out of time. The Western, this is the average aerosol loading, lots of the Chinese industrial aerosols, etc., etc. Here's Bodeli Depression, and in summertime we see this big West African area, much wider area of extreme dust loadings. They call this the West African hotspot. Can we explain that? This is the wintertime when Bodeli Depression is most important, but in summertime, Bodeli is still active, but There's a huge area of West Africa that sort of has a higher loading, but for a shorter period of time. Can we explain that? That's the target. Well, the summertime Sahara is very different. It's still extremely hot, but the southwest monsoon, the Sahelian West African monsoon, is much closer. So in wintertime, the rainfall's all down here across the equatorial. But in summertime, the rainfall's up here, cloud and rainfall up about 15 degrees north over the Sahel, which is their wet season and supports all the agriculture in this very marginal part of West Africa. Very important feature, the West African monsoon, for livelihoods. But over the central Sahara, over here where the dust is what we call a heat low. It's the hottest place on the planet. Temperatures regulate up to 50 degrees, high 40s to 50. It produces low pressure system, and the winds kind of circulate in from the north, hot northeasterlies, and cool, moist southwesterlies. And of course, the convection, the rainfall in yellow here, these thunderstorms are very much closer to the Sahara than they are in winter. And they're organized in this sort of wavy pattern, these waves which move along from east to west, called African easterly waves. And that's the kind of the system that we have, the kind of climatological system that we have in West Africa in summertime. We have the hot, dry Sahara, but much closer to it are these intrusions of moist air which come up from the south, from the monsoon, cool, moist air with thunderstorms organized in this kind of wavy pattern. So the question that I'm just skipping back there to was how can we explain this? Again, no one's really been there to study it until recently. So how do we explain it? Well, Engelstadter and Washington, colleagues I've worked with in the previous BODEX experiment, had a stab at that, and they looked at the annual cycle. This is the annual cycle of dust over the year, 12 months, showing the peak in the summertime dust season. And they noticed it doesn't really correlate with winds, with wind speed, as it should do, because winds drive dust. They said, well, it doesn't really correlate with winds, but it correlates much more with the sort of the gustiness, the sort of high individual little gusts of wind. And they suggested actually it's all to do with micro-scale processes, dust devils like this, that are just driven by hot air. And so they suggested that over this vast area of the Western Sahara, there was just thousands and thousands and thousands of these dust devils. No one had any data to verify it, but that was a hypothesis based on what the observations were in relation to average wind speeds. So is the West African surface covered in sort of many thousands of these dust devils day in, day out? Well, some observations, it's a kind of an instrument called a LIDAR, and you can see with height here at a particular point through time, you can see some of these dust devils appearing in LIDAR data. This is over Morocco, in fact, far to the north rather than over the central Sahara. That's the first hypothesis. And then myself and Peter Kniepertz from University of Leeds did some analysis, and we said, well, let's look at this area of dust here from the satellite data, and let's see how it varies, because it's not like that every day. Dust goes up and dust goes down. And let's relate it to the large-scale circulation. And what we found a day before you get a lot of dust over here, you get a strong southerly wind over this area to the east. And that wind will be moist and cool and will contain lots of thunderstorms. And so actually we figured that really the dust here was not coming from that region itself, but was coming from the west, east rather, and being exported into that region. And that was our hypothesis. So the conclusion was that the hotspot is a result of local emission, yes, but also importantly transport from other sources organized by these African easterly waves, the kind of the weather systems of North Africa. And actually, when you go there, and we've now got experiments, the AMA experiment and the Fennec field experiment, which I've been a principal investigator on, the dominant feature that you see is this very, very different type of dust storm called a haboob, which just means, I think, strong wind in Arabic. And you may have seen it on some of these BBC natural history programs. And they generally precede rainfall. So here's a wall of dust which comes piling across the desert or the Sahel. And people are not too displeased to see them, because following this will be rain. And we can see that from a space shuttle here. This is this wall of dust which moves across the desert at high speed and is basically produced by all these thunderstorms to the south. And these haboob features are really very dramatic, and they can extend basically they're produced by downdrafts, cold air descending within thunderstorm systems and then flowing out from the thunderstorms, producing all this dust. And they cover many hundreds or even thousands of kilometers. Here's a convective rainfall system, a thunderstorm in red, and here's the dust in pink. So that haboob, like that, is about the size of the UK, or bigger, in fact. And it flashes across the desert in the space of perhaps 6 or 12 hours or so. And it's all driven by cold air sinking from this thunderstorm. So a little movie. which demonstrates the power of these events. These, the red here, the dark red is thunderstorms, and the pink is dust. And we can see here these thunderstorms over southern Algeria, thunderstorms developing, and here's the Habib system flowing away. We'll just catch it at the end there. You can see that it flows away from the edge of that deep thunderstorm system. Just in case you didn't catch it first time, there's one there. And then as the thunderstorms develop over central Algeria, over the Sahara Desert itself, we get these Habib systems propagating away. So the Sahara Desert in summertime is not always dry. There's often convective activity either over the Sahara and more often to the south, which produces these Habib systems. So with a slightly bigger budget than the BODEX experiments, probably an order of about three orders of magnitude more, almost three orders of magnitude of budget bigger, the FENIC project, Climate of the Sahara, which started last year and was set out to measure much more comprehensively, but it's much less fun actually. In fact, big projects are just not as much fun really. And we set up some instrumentation in the desert, we flew the research aircraft, and we have satellite data, and we do drop balloons from the aircraft, and then we drop down to the surface and fly back up again and do lots of fancy maneuvers in the UK research aircraft, as well as the French aircraft, across the central Sahara to try and find out what it's all about. And the benefits of that, of course, is that you can fly above the dust layer. This is not cloud, this is just dust. And it's got a very, very sharp cap at the top of the boundary layer, about 6 kilometer height. You can fly above it and measure the radiation and the energy budget above that, and you can fly right below it to measure the effect on energy, and you can measure the dust and find out lots and lots of interesting aspects of dust. FENIC has only just really started. We had a field campaign this summer, and we haven't really analysed the results. So the results of FENIC are not well known, are not established yet, so it's too early days. But one example of why it's important, you might think it's not too important to spend £3 million of taxpayers' money on flying an airplane around the desert. One of the reasons that the government is prepared to spend £3 million of taxpayers' money is because the military main involvement now happens to be in very arid regions. That's where Britain likes to fight its wars. And dust storms are the main aviation hazard. So the Met Office, which is a Ministry of Defence institution, needs to have better forecasts for aviation, civilian and also military. But here's an example of why we need it. This is a forecast, weather forecast from the Met Office model. Met Office is a really very, very good limited area model over Africa. It's not suggesting any cloud there. Well, in reality, at that time, there's a big, big thunderstorm over that region of central Sahara. The model didn't produce it. And there's the Habib, which resulted from it. This is the pink of the dust. So there's an example of a weather forecast which failed to predict a giant thunderstorm over the central Sahara, which produced this enormous Habib wall of dust which propagated out across the desert. The dust forecast itself, this is a weather forecast. We also produce forecasts of dust. No evidence in this case of any dust in that particular forecast. So basically our models, our weather forecast models, do not simulate very well these features in the Saharan atmosphere. But this is some work I've done myself with the postdoc on the project, and when we move to very, 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 very detailed models with sort of five kilometer resolution, we can simulate these very strong winds which are associated with this thunderstorm. So when we can improve our models by getting more detail in them, and hopefully that will improve our ability to make forecasts of not just the weather, but also forecasts in terms of longer term climate predictions and the role that dust plays on the climate system. I've been going on for probably far too long. I haven't looked at the clock, but I'll summarise now. Recent progress. Based upon lots of new satellite data sets and also these field campaigns, BODEX and FENIC in particular that I've been directly involved in, have built up a picture of how dust works over the Sahara. And what we find is quite a contrast between the winter season and the summer season. In the winter season, it's these low-level jets, these nocturnal low-level jet wind features, which during the daytime get mixed down to the surface and produce strong winds, especially over this Paleo Lake, this coincidence of very strong winds blowing over this ancient lake sediment makes this Bodelli Depression. Every second day in winter, a big, huge dust plume will be pumped out of the Bedell Depression. 10% of all dust emitted comes from the globally comes from the Bedell, and about 50% of all dust transport to the Amazon comes from that one location. And this may fertilize both the Amazon rainforest and also the intervening ocean. But the detail of that question remains unresolved. In the summertime, where we have this much wider, bigger, that question answered, this big area of dust over West Africa remained an intriguing question. And what we find then is that in summertime we have these low-level jet features, but what's more important probably are these big convective, big weather, these thunderstorms, which produce these walls of dust which propagate many hundreds or thousands of kilometers across the desert, called haboobs. So dust emission and the transport is driven by these convective systems organized by African easterly waves, and that explains why we have that great big hotspot over West Africa. And that's the season when hurricanes form. So it's this dust here which really drives and influences the formation of hurricanes out in the Atlantic, and then as they move across to the Caribbean and North America. So that's a kind of summary really of the kind of work I've been involved in, which has advanced our understanding of this very important process within the climate system. So the ability then to model these processes has been greatly improved through these observations and through these hypotheses that we've developed and tested out. That will give us better weather predictions and also better climate predictions for decades into the future. So you can all shake your heads and wake up. Thank you very much for listening.